Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. A dozen buildings torched, scores of shots fired, nearly 100 arrests. That's the scorecard following the announcement last night that Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson will not be indicted for shooting and killing Michael Brown in Ferguson on August 9th. Violent demonstrations followed the shooting. What happened following the grand jury decision last night has been called worse than any of the earlier demonstrations. Now what? We'll take a look at where Ferguson goes from here on today's program. We'll be joined in a moment by Patricia Bynes, Democratic committeewoman for Ferguson Township. We'll also be talking with numerous others, including Archbishop Robert Carlson later. A Brown Family News Conference is taking place now, including Reverend Al Sharpton. We'll have details on that when the news conference ends. But now back to committeewoman Bynes. Patricia, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's been a long night, and I know you were so actively involved in trying to keep the lid on. Your thoughts about what transpired following the announcement of the grand jury's decision last night?
Well, this is just absolutely devastating, starting from, we're under a state of emergency, but I witnessed police officers not really doing anything when looting and fires were started. You're trying to make sense of calling a conference to announce the indictment at 8 o'clock at night, and then just watching buildings burn. They're still burning now, and you can still see smoke happening in certain places around Ferguson. This is devastating. Am I angry? Oh yes, I understand the anger, but this is not the way.
Anger obviously is the key word. Those folks on the streets last night, very much so. Needless to say, very obviously.
Yeah, anger. Rage, and some opportunists, and this is not the way. This isn't even revenge. This certainly isn't justice, because the community that's involved, they didn't. I don't think anybody deserved this if they owned a business. They didn't do anything to deserve this.
You know, it looked like some headway was being made. I know there were a lot of meetings that were being held, and you were involved in many of them, as I said earlier, in trying to keep the lid on, and that there seemed to be a fairly widespread agreement that certainly there would be protests no matter what the grand jury's decision was, but that they would not reach the stage that they reached last night. What happened?
Well, I had been urging for about 2 weeks now for peaceful protests. When the news of the indictment came, to stay home, because I knew that there would be people just hell-bent on getting to the streets for destruction. And I did not want people who were legitimately involved and who wanted peaceful protests to be involved in that, because we're at the point where if you're not actively going to stop it, you're just allowing it to happen. And I knew that people would be angry and they would use this as an opportunity to do something like this, and this is exactly what happened.
The question, I guess, is what happens now? Is this a one-time affair, would you expect, or can we look forward to more of the same?
I have been in contact and tried to tell people that I don't expect this to just be one night. I think we need to look and see if this happens again, and it's unfortunate. We have the resources here. The governor called the National Guard in. I am begging that he actually use them to continue to protect the rest of Ferguson and not just allow law enforcement to sit back and watch this burn. I know that, this isn't the high-income area of Clayton and Chesterfield and those places, but please don't just sit back and let the rest of the city burn.
Has there been any kind of an explanation to your satisfaction as to why the guard wasn't brought in last night? I know Mayor Knowles has been very critical of the fact that they weren't called.
I put some calls in, and I'm waiting on my phone to ring.
Calls to whom?
To people who need to be calling me back to give me the answers that I need.
What's on tap for today for you? I mean, obviously, you're very much involved. What can you do today, do you think, to, again, kind of tamp down some of this emotion?
Well, I don't know if there's anything that I can do to reach out to the people who were burning things. What I can do is reach out to the community that's been devastated by this, that were not involved in burning things. that's what I can do, call on people, check on people, because we're all pretty much going through the same thing. Like, this is beyond heartbreaking. I almost just don't have words for this. So I don't know how I can reach someone who actually did this, even through the anger and knowing that there is injustice here. We got to fight, but this isn't the way to fight, not like this.
Do you have the sense or the outright knowledge that out-of-town people were a big part of what happened last night?
Well, I was looking at reports, and they were saying that the majority of people arrested and were involved were not from out-of-town. And I have been trying to tell people that, yes, we look at out-of-town people, but there's things going on right here locally. So I know that there are people out last night who have not been involved so much in the peaceful protests. And I have said that we would expect them to come back out, local people who are not involved in peaceful protests, and that's exactly what happened.
There has been some criticism of the clergy in Ferguson for not being more visible out on the streets and trying to, soothe the situation, if I can put it that way.
Now, I'm not quite sure what clergy could do. Anybody who's tried to do anything involved in this has been criticized. There are just some clergy that there's a huge disconnect between the people who burn things. They aren't necessarily going to churches on Sunday, so I'm not quite sure how much outreach clergy can do, because I have seen some really good clergy on the ground putting in the grunt work to reach out and help people. So, you know, just like it's not all police, just like it's not all protesters, just like it's not all media, it's not all clergy either.
Well, we'll let you get back to work. I know there's plenty that you feel you have to do, and we wish you the greatest success in doing what you feel you have to do out there in Ferguson. Patricia Bynes, committee woman for Ferguson Township, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
Have a good one. I'm going to turn now to my colleague, Chris McDaniel, who is with me in studio. We're backtracking a little bit from where we started this program as we wait for certain things to develop during the course of the afternoon, including the Brown Family News Conference. Chris has been active in looking over the information that was reviewed by the grand jury and which has come to him in great volume. Chris, 5,000 pages, do I understand?
Yes. So the information that we're talking about here, we're talking about witness testimony. We're talking about evidence reports, reports by St. Louis County. In total, we got a hold of more than 5,000 documents. I've probably looked through 600, if I have to guess. So I'm part of a team that's going through this, but we are still very much in the process of weeding through this.
Needless to say, I'm sure there's much of great interest in all of that documentation. What has stuck out in your mind?
Well, I am going through witness testimony right now, and perhaps unsurprisingly, what has stuck out to me is Officer Wilson's testimony. There were a lot of things that stuck out to me in his testimony. I think over the past few months, we've heard a lot about Mike Brown's size. And what stuck out to me in Darren Wilson's testimony was that he's a large man as well. According to his estimate, he's about 6'4", 210 pounds. Mike Brown, according to his autopsy, is 6'5", 289 pounds. So there is a size discrepancy there, but it's not as much as you would have thought.
There was talk of the struggle in the car, obviously. We've heard so many different versions of what happened there. What have you been able to find out?
Well, I can only say that this is what Officer Wilson has said. And how he is phrasing it is that there was a struggle in his car. He was punched twice in the face. He said that he was worried about the third one possibly being fatal. I should point out that we do have some hospital photos of him at the hospital. I have to say that there is some redness, but it is not anything dramatic. I understand that you've seen it as well. He was worried that the third shot or the third punch could be fatal. That's when he said he took out his gun. According to Officer Wilson, that is when Mike Brown grabbed his gun and said, quote, "He's too much of an expletive to shoot me." He pulled the trigger twice and nothing happened. And then when he pulled it the third time, a shot came out inside the car.
And that shot, I think, nicked his Brown's thumb or something of that nature.
It's tough to say which shot it was that nicked his thumb. But after that, that is when Mike Brown moved away, ran away. And there's kind of a quote here that Officer Wilson closed out with. I'm going to read it here. It's sort of his closing statement here to the grand jury. One thing you guys haven't asked that has been asked of me in other interviews is, was he a threat? Was Michael Brown a threat when he was running away? People asked, why would you chase him if he was running away? I had already called for assistance. If someone arrives and sees him running, another officer, and goes around the back half of the apartment complex and tries to stop him, what would stop him from doing what he just did to me, or worse, knowing he has already done it to one cop? So he's sort of defending his actions in spite of Mike Brown running away at that time.
And obviously the grand jury thought that that was a part of the story they wanted to accept. If you don't mind sticking around, I'd like to bring you in later in the program. We'll have a former police officer who was involved in a police shooting here, and maybe you two can kick it around a little bit. But we are going to move on now. We have yet an – whoops. Let me amend that. The officer I just mentioned has just walked into the room. This would be Dave Klinger. And many of you know Dave. He's a criminal justice professor at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, and a former Los Angeles police officer. Dave, catch your breath in just a second. Nice to see you. We've just listened to Chris McDaniel talk about the grand jury testimony from Wilson. I don't know if you heard any of that. Give me your sense of the police officer in crisis. You've been there.
Yeah, I've been there, and I've interviewed about 300 police officers who've been involved in shootings across the country. And from a police officer's perspective, you have to understand a few things. Number one is training. And one of the things police officers are trained is that if an individual is trying to take your gun away, that and it's reasonable to believe that they're actually going to be successful, you shoot them off the gun. That's the term of art. And so I would imagine that Officer Wilson, if in fact that is what happened, was quite scared because if someone is trying to murder you, that does tend to raise your emotional level.
Or if you think someone is trying
exactly.
to murder you.
And so also, I just want to preface everything. I haven't had a chance to read all of his testimony. I haven't had a chance to look at a lot of the evidence. And so I'm going to offer conjecture about what could have been going through the officer's mind, because I think that's what you're asking me to do, to put the listeners into that space. So at any rate, so that's the first thing. And so apparently he fired two shots to try to get Michael Brown off his gun to protect himself. And then the next question becomes, what do you do once he breaks away? And so police officers are trained to pursue criminals, and apparently there was a brief foot pursuit. And then when Mr. Brown comes back to face Officer Wilson, now we have the big question. What is going on? Is this individual going to surrender to me? Is he going to attack me? Is he going to just stand there and argue with me? We don't know. And so the officer has to make an assessment about what this individual is going to do, and then that is going to lead to him interpreting whatever the suspect does from that point forward. And so a police officer now could be thinking, this individual just tried to murder me. I believe he just tried to kill me. And now he may be coming back at me. And then if the individual advances towards the officer could well believe he's going to try to disarm me again. And so I need to use deadly force to protect myself. Now, whether that's what happened, I don't know. As I indicated, I want to be able to have a chance to take a look at all the evidence before I would draw any conclusion that that was a reasonable action for him to take because he had a reasonable belief his life was in jeopardy at that moment.
You, at one time, while a police officer in Los Angeles, were in a position where you actually shot and killed a man who was assaulting your partner, as
right.
I recall.
Right.
Can you give me some sense of what your mindset was at that time compared to what you were just saying you think Officer
right.
Wilson was going through?
Absolutely. To give a little bit of background, my partner and I, a guy named Dennis Acevedo, had been called to a barricaded gunman situation on an east-west street in south central Los Angeles. And my partner was on the south side of the street. I was on the north side of the street. He was attempting to clear out the last of a number of citizens who were watching what was going on. And out of nowhere, the individual pulled a butcher's knife out of his Nike bag, stabbed my partner in the chest, and then chased my partner maybe 20 feet down a sidewalk. My partner tripped. The guy jumped on top of him. And as I'm running across the street, the guy jumps on top of Dennis, and he's literally trying to drive the knife through his throat. I tried to take the knife away. It didn't work. My partner said, shoot him. And so now I'm thinking, I have missed identified this. I thought I could take the knife away. I'm not able to. And probably in less than a second, I'm thinking all these things. I don't want to shoot this guy, but I tried to take the knife away and that didn't work. I need to stop him from trying to murder my partner, so I got to shoot him. And then I'm also thinking I don't want to hit Dennis because they're grappling over the knife. And so I had to calm myself for just a second. I picked out a spot on the left side of the suspect's chest, aimed there, pulled the trigger. And as soon as the bullet hit him, Dennis had his arms basically were bent at the elbows as they're fighting over the knife. As soon as I pulled the trigger, he was able to lock his elbows out, which meant in my mind that now he had some control of the knife. So I went back in, grabbed the suspect's wrist, and we were able to get the knife away from him probably 30 seconds later. And I had killed the guy. He just hadn't died yet. And he continued to fight us. Some other officers showed up. We eventually got him into handcuffs. But it was a very – I mean, as I look back on it, it's 33 and almost a half years – the most critical few seconds of my life.
It probably happened a lot more quickly than it took you to tell the story.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, which is part of the problem when it comes to making these kinds of decisions.
Right, and I would just estimate that from the time the attack started till the time I shot him was probably 20 seconds, and my actual involvement in being at my partner's side till the time I shot him was 3 to 5 seconds max.
If you and Chris McDaniel can stay with us for a while, I'd like to get back to some of this. But we have another guest in studio that I want to get to because he's got another appointment coming up very, very quickly. And that would be Willis Johnson of the Wellspring Church in Ferguson. Thank you so much for being with us. It's nice talking to you again. It seems like only a few hours ago that we had a conversation. I know you're very, very disappointed with the way things turned out last night. Now that you've had a chance to reflect on it for a few hours, what are you thinking?
Continue to be not only disappointed, but after walking through the community today and talking with not only business owners adjacent to our church property and friends and parishioners, even more saddened that sometimes we don't recognize the actions that we take and how impactful they are. No one wants to discourage freedom of expression. No one wants to discount the emotion and the in many cases the justifiable feelings, the feelings that are justified by a longstanding set of historical, systemic, and cultural challenges that this community has faced. But you can't help but just ask why. And is this what brings resolution or brings the change that we were hoping for or hope for? That's what I'm hearing. That's what I feel. That's what I'm wrestling with even right now, Don.
What do you think might have been done to prevent last night from happening, assuming that the grand jury was going to not indict Officer Wilson? What could have been done?
You know, you've probably heard a list of things already. I mean, we could go from anywhere from the time of the announcement to the de-escalating of the announcement by announcing it much sooner and not having it so prolonged in nature. And we can get into the optics and the politics and the aesthetics of the whole thing. But I was confronted just today by someone challenging me who has had an opportunity to have voice and platform and many on many levels. And I was challenged to say that by that person to say, well, I didn't do enough. I should have said people shouldn't do such and such. Well, newsflash to you and anyone else. We've been saying don't riot, don't loot. We've been saying that we need to be responsible and respectful in our responses. But I don't know what you can do short of confrontation with individuals who are purposed towards doing something as damning and as destructive and as detrimental and disrespectful as to what took place last night.
You know, what you might be referring to is something that I've been reading and hearing, and that is there are certain people, certain officials in the city of Ferguson who are saying, where were the clergy last night? We didn't see them out in the street. We didn't see them as we did last time around in August.
Yeah.
Is that what you're referring to?
Well, I've heard those comments, but I'm just being very candid about a particular encounter that I had this afternoon. But for folks that say that, I think it's not accurate. There was clergy present. We ourselves at Wellspring were not only available and present in the community, but we were providing resource and respite to people who were caught up in that situation. For full disclosure, at the time of the announcement, I was in Clayton. I rushed back to be not just at my church where I pastor and work, but I live in Ferguson, Brother Don. I was met by armored vehicles and officers who had already begun the lockdown of South Florissant and could not get to my residence. I had to do some very creative things to get to my home, to get to my wife. Okay, and yeah. So for everyone who is asking about what I or other clergy may be doing, and the question is, what have we been trying to do preemptive of this? What have we done in the midst of it? We're doing what everybody else is doing, trying our darndest to encourage people to model and to be present at the same time, be respectful to our own responsibilities as well.
Where does it go from here? With regard to what's likely to happen in your view and what your role is going to be from this day forward. Yeah.
Well, I continue to personally believe that we can and must get better, that there's a more perfect way. There's a higher moral ground that we can take, or road we can take and ground we can achieve. I believe that what we've been doing and trying personally to create space for continuous conversation, deep, engaging conversation, creating and providing resource and space not only for that, but then modeling and exercising types of leadership that do that, speaking to the narrative. Not just talking about what is happening, but and not just tell people what to think, but challenge them to think, because we're not doing that enough, and not tell people what to do or what not to do. You know, obviously there's some means and some boundaries too, and some burdens that come with the decisions and actions, but all of us need to recognize that we need to remain answerable and accountable to the hard work of this. It starts all over.
Starts all over again. Have to start all over again.
Each day, every day.
Got to let you go now. I know you have another appointment in about 45 seconds.
Well, thank you for having me.
Wish we could talk longer, but Willis Johnson, thanks so much for being with us. Good luck with your work. I mean, obviously, we need people like you out there making your voice heard, but more importantly, having people listen. Thank you so much, sir, for being with us.
Thank you.
That's Reverend Willis Johnson of the Wellspring Church in Ferguson. We have to take a break. We'll do that now and come back and continue our conversation. We're obviously talking about the situation in Ferguson today, just a few hours after the grand jury decided that it would not indict Officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson for the August 9th shooting of Michael Brown. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back. As we continue our conversation concerning the situation in Ferguson, following last night's disturbances, which, of course, followed the announcement by the grand jury, or by Prosecutor Bob McCullough, that the grand jury had decided not to indict Officer Darren Wilson. With me still in studio, we have other guests coming, by the way, but still with me in studio are Dave Klinger, former police officer and criminology professor at the University of Missouri-St. Louis, and Chris McDaniel, St. Louis Public Radio reporter. Going back, and I hate to be bouncing around like this, but have no choice under these circumstances. Chris, you listened to Dave a few moments ago talking about the kinds of things that he has gone through personally and knows that officers go through. Can you connect the dots between what he said and what you've been reading about Darren Wilson?
Yeah, I think so, without, you know, trying to get too much into someone else's head here. But, you know, from Officer Wilson's testimony, the way that he described Mike Brown, he sort of described him as superhuman. He has one quote where he said that he felt like a 5-year-old holding on to Hulk Hogan when he grabbed him. He said, it looks like a demon was one of the ways that he phrased it. And then at the point when Mike Brown has stopped running away and, according to Officer Wilson's testimony, has started moving towards him. He has this quote that I'm going to read. At this point, it looked like he was almost bulking up to run through the shots, like it was making him mad that I'm shooting him. And the face that he had, he was looking straight through me like I wasn't even there, like I wasn't even anything in his way. So he's definitely built him up, or at least is portraying his mental state at that time where he's built him up into something superhuman.
Dave Klinger, how does this sound to you? I mean, this imagery is right. Really quite fascinating.
I don't know about the particular language, but as he was reading that, resonated with me. Several of the officers I interviewed talking about situations where they shot people multiple times and the people kept coming at them. And so that sounds about right in terms of how an officer is framing an encounter with an individual who he believes is trying to kill him or her. And I mean, it is very telling that when a police officer is in this moment, he or she literally understands that if they make the wrong decision, they may go to the autopsy table themselves. And if they hold fire and if they shoot when they shouldn't, they can end up before a jury. And so it's very disconcerting.
You know, this is one of the things that that people in the other world, the civilian world, just don't get in terms of what the emotions and the psychology of all of this involves.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating because oftentimes officers do have this visceral, emotional, guttural fear, for lack of a better term. And for other officers, it's just a very clinical situation. A very good friend of mine, he was a classmate in the academy. And his story is in my book, Into the Kill Zone. To make a long story short, he tried to disarm an individual who was attacking his wife. And the guy had a knife. And my friend hit him as hard as he could. And my friend's about 6'2", 225, a big guy, hit him with his nightstick to try to disarm him. And the suspect spun on him real quick and cut him in the arm, almost ended up bleeding to death. Took 63 stitches to close it. But at any rate, he said, at that point, I went into a very clinical problem-solving modality. I'd just been cut. I didn't want to get cut again. How do I solve this? Oh, I shoot the guy before he cuts me again. So we have quite a range of how it is that officers experience things. So we have, akin to Darren Wilson, officers talking about this monster who is attacking me, this individual who is trying to murder me, and guttural fear, and then clinical dispatch. And so you never know what you're going to get. And the officers themselves don't know how they're going to respond until that moment arrives.
Right. I have to take a break in our conversation once again. Things are very, very, very fluid here today, as I'm sure our audience has seen. We have Archbishop Carlson with us on the line, Archbishop Robert Carlson. Thank you so much, sir, for being with us. Nice to have you on the line.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
And I know you've been listening to what the police world is like. I'd like to get some sense from you of what your world is like following what happened last night in Ferguson.
Well, obviously we have people of faith about every point of the spectrum you can imagine. We were up in Ferguson having a prayer service, actually, even before the announcement, and the people there were very, very concerned afterwards, wondered if they could get home. And yet at the same time, they felt it was important to do what they could, which they felt most appropriately would be to pray for the families involved, both the young man who was killed and also for the police officer and his family, and at the same time pray for peace in our community. We also had, I'm sure, some people out in peaceful protest, hopefully not anyone out in violent protest, but Catholic Church is quite large, and I'm sure we had people in many different places.
How do you see the role of clergy in situations such as these? I mean, obviously, prayer gives great solace to a great many, but what about a different role for the clergy? Do you see that?
Well, obviously, at the time of emotional impact, you want to caution people for calm. In the long range, you want to encourage people to deal with the issues behind the issue, if you will. One of the things that is becoming clearer and clearer to me is back in the 60s when we passed a number of laws, we thought we had done our job, but somehow we failed to talk to each other, to come to know each other across the races as human beings and There are obviously are fears that exist, and in the long run, if we're going to deal with systemic racism, we have to hear from each other and hear our fears, our concerns, and our hopes and dreams.
You know, with all due respect, we've been hearing things like this for the last 40, 50 years. I mean, every time there is an incident of any kind, we talk about having conversations and about doing the kinds of things that you suggest. And yet they just keep happening. And there doesn't seem to be much improvement in this relationship between the races.
Yeah, this might surprise you, but I agree with you. About 3 years ago, I tried to get 50 people from the black community and the white community to sit down and to talk, and I was not successful. And yet at the same time, I believe if we don't do that, we're going to find ourselves repeating this over and over again.
Where do we go from here?
Well, obviously we have to continue to pray because God can do things that we can't. At the same time, I think we have to realize that there are legitimate protesters out there who are people of peace, and I think we have to deal with those criminal elements or anarchists who are also involved, because what they're doing is destroying our community, and we have to be concerned about that as well.
And you're giving folks the opportunity, you and the Archdiocese, giving folks the opportunity to get together this evening, as I understand it.
Well, even last night, we had a number of churches open for prayer, so people could go if they wanted to. Some are going to be open for 48 hours. And yes, that's true. At 5 o'clock this afternoon, we are going to have a Mass for Justice and Peace. Hopefully, giving people some opportunity to express what they're feeling and to get together and to worship and pray.
Archbishop Robert Carlson, good luck to you in that effort. Everybody wishes you well, needless to say. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation. God bless.
Archbishop Robert Carlson of the St. Louis Archdiocese. We'll come back and continue this conversation in just a moment. Again, we are talking about the aftermath of the grand jury decision in Ferguson not to indict Officer Darren Wilson. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. I'm Don Marsh. With me in studio are Chris McDaniel, St. Louis Public Radio reporter, Dave Klinger, criminology professor at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. In a few minutes, we'll be talking with a gentleman from the Shaw neighborhood, that South Grand Community, I should say, association. But first, I'd like to go to our colleague Nancy Fowler of St. Louis Public Radio. She, as I mentioned at the outset, has been covering the Brown Family News Conference in which Reverend Al Sharpton was a participant. Nancy, are you there?
Yes, I am, Don.
All righty. Well, tell us what transpired at the news conference.
Well, at the news conference, Michael Brown's mother, Leslie McSpadden, did not attend, and Michael Brown's father did not speak. But Al Sharpton and also the family attorney, Benjamin Crump, had quite a lot to say, you know, obviously, and is no surprise. They said the decision was a sham and that McCullough presented info but did not cross-examine. Well, there was no opportunity for anyone to cross-examine it. And Reverend L. Sharpman summed it up saying, it broke our hearts, he said, but it did not break our backs. And he has a plan for moving forward.
Any indication as to what that plan might involve?
Yes, he has scheduled what he calls a civil rights meeting next week in Washington, D.C., and they will, I'm not sure who they are at this point, but there will be a strategy hammered out and, you know, further plans. He puts a lot of stake in going forward in the federal efforts. And he brought up the name of Rodney King and compared it to that situation in California, saying that and pointing out that there was acquittal in the initial round, and a different outcome at the federal level. So he said, this is not our first rodeo, McCullough.
The one of the most pointed things that we heard during the final hours before the grand jury decision was the Brown family appealing for calm and peace following that decision, whatever it might have been. Was there any, did they address that at all today, the fact that that appeal from the family obviously did not work?
They did not. They did say that they very much condemn the violence that took place last night. Reverend Sharpton also saying, we also condemn the violence that took place on August 9th with the killing of Michael Brown.
I know, Nancy, it's already been a long day for you that started in Ferguson itself. Can you tell us what it was that you were seeing in the early hours of this morning as the sun was coming up?
Yes. Well, at about 5 a.m., I pulled up and attempted to go down West Forest Road at Lucas and Hunt, but it was blocked off all the way to Chambers, and in fact, that is still the case here. And you could see just pillars of smoke coming from that area, but that wasn't the site of not the only site of burning buildings, because very shortly on Newhall's Ferry at the Family Dollar, there is a fire that devastated the building, and it was still smoldering. And as I watched, the fire trucks pulled up and hoisted a 60-foot crane, sort of a mechanism, and sprayed the entire structure from above. And there were other efforts to put out other fires that were smoldering in the area, and there were people cleaning up. One family, Ferguson family, man and a woman and their three children, three young boys, came and swept up glass and, you know, just did what they could.
And people who might have been identified as protesters were not visible, I take it.
No, there were. Are you asking if there were any protesters this morning?
Yeah, just if any were still milling around.
No, there was one woman on with a sign on her back as she was sweeping up glass, and it said, still peacefully protesting.
Any police presence there this morning?
The only police presence was at the barricades. As I said, that stretch of West Florissant was blocked off from every sort of entrance area, and that was just by regular patrol cars, and I saw no other police presence.
Aside from the sign, did you have any opportunity to talk to any people who were out there cleaning up and whatever about their thoughts about what had gone on?
I did. The young family I mentioned, the dad said he's upset about the damage, but he does understand the anger behind it. And he said, there's a lot more than glass broken here in this city, and it's going to take much more than just a physical cleanup of the mess.
There is such a deep feeling. We can sense it even here. Of disappointment with regard to events as they transpired.
Yes, very deep disappointment. Shock, even though, many expected the outcome to be what it was. But, yes, still a lot of disappointment.
Any sense while you were there, and this may be an unfair question, that this this mood and these actions will continue?
I believe they will. I mean, I believe they will. I can't imagine that they wouldn't. But I guess we'll all have to see.
That, indeed, we will have to do. Nancy Fowler, thanks so much for being with us. Anything you'd want to add before we say goodbye?
No, I think that's it. I think we'll just have to see what happens tonight.
Okay. Well, we'll welcome you back here in the office in just a bit. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Don.
That's Nancy Fowler, a St. Louis Public Radio reporter who was on the scene in Ferguson early this morning and who covered the news conference, the Brown family news conference involving Reverend Al Sharpton just a few minutes ago. Now we'll move on to another area of our community, which was stricken last night by demonstrations. We're joined in studio by Christopher Sherman of the South Grand Community Improvement District. Chris, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tough night for you last night, but not as tough as it was in Ferguson.
No, that's right. Yeah. We had so many people out last night showing their support for South Grand, for the neighborhood, people peacefully protesting, and then a handful of individuals that took the opportunity to do some vandalism.
I wonder why it was different in your neighborhood than it was elsewhere.
We have a unique neighborhood. It's economically diverse. It's racially diverse. There are a lot of people from different backgrounds, but they take the time to, empathize and to educate themselves. It's a unique place, and I love being a part of it.
Did the neighborhood and the neighbors sense that the decision by the grand jury probably would go the way that it did? And if, in fact, they did feel that way, did they prepare for it last night?
There was a lot of speculation, and there wasn't a consensus about how it would turn out, regardless of what the outcome was going to be. It was planned that there would be protests in the neighborhood. There would be, shows of support for the Brown family. So regardless of what the decision was going to be, there was going to be a show of support for that family. Like I said, it's a neighborhood that takes the time to consider these things and to empathize. And the underlying factors that have led us here are things that we will have to deal with.
There were a few arrests down there last night, as I understand. Give me a sense of what the what damage there was, what in fact it was.
So I believe the mayor was saying at one point that they were going to arrest people based on actions and not on their words. So there reaches a point where those actions cross over, and that was points of vandalism, broken windows. We didn't have the problems of looting. We didn't have the problems of fires or anything like that. The police were very much focused on allowing the protesters to express their riot free speech, and then taking care of issues as they came along. I understand that there may be a different approach tonight as far as just being more present along the businesses, just so that it provides less of an opportunity for vandalism. But it tended to be. Although it still hurts and it's frustrating, but it tended to just be broken glass and vandalism.
And of course, Highway 44 was shut down for a while by these folks, was it not?
44 was shut down, but watching that on the news, I live only a matter of blocks from there. Mm-hmm. You could see that the approach was it seemed more structured than what we've seen in some other areas. That people made their point. They came. They were disruptive. Did not create bigger problems that could have arisen, and then went along their way.
Any National Guard presence in your area last night?
I didn't observe any. I was all along South Grand, more or less from 44 down towards nearly Gravois. I know that they are stationed at various places in the city. My understanding is that they are providing backup support, and I'm not sure if that role will change, but that they will allow for the St. Louis police to be more hands-on in areas that are more affected.
I understand Chief Dotson said this morning that there will be more resources made available tonight. And as you indicated a moment or two ago, you are anticipating the probability of more demonstrations this evening.
Oh, I would expect that there be more demonstrations. I've also seen just an amazing outpouring from the neighborhood. People are coming out. They're dining on South Grand. They're buying coffee. They're going out to eat. People are being very supportive of the neighborhood right now.
All righty. Well, good. Let's hope it stays that way.
Definitely.
Chris Shearman, thanks so much. Before you go, I'll just read the statement just handed to me from Governor Nixon regarding events in Ferguson last night. He said there will be more National Guardsmen supporting law enforcement in the St. Louis region tonight. The governor has been meeting this morning with Guard and law enforcement leaders to plan for the use of additional Guard resources to protect lives and property in Ferguson and in the entire region, which I guess could certainly include the South Grand neighborhood. Chris, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Have a good day and have an even better evening if you follow my drift. Thank you. Now, we'll go back to our friends Dave Klinger and Chris McDaniel. One of the things, Dave, that has struck me has been the frequent mention of a relatively new tool for law enforcement, and that is the taser.
Right.
Chris, the word taser popped up in your research, too, into the transcripts from the grand jury.
Yes. Officer Wilson testified before the grand jury that he did not have a taser. He says he normally doesn't carry a taser. They only have a select amount, and he usually decides not to carry one anyway because he says it's not comfortable and it's too clunky.
Right. Well, a lot of people have criticized police for not using the taser more often, Dave Klinger. But the taser isn't the most effective tool that a cop can have on his belt.
No, it's not. And I think people also have to understand that tasers have come under a great deal of fire, pardon the pun, from the American Civil Liberties Union, Amnesty International, and other groups for saying that it's a torture device. It should only be used in the most gravest of my poor English. I've been up, like all of us, running on low sleep. At any rate, only in the gravest types of circumstances. And so it's fascinating to me that officers use a taser and they're criticized. You tased him. You shocked him. Why'd you do that? Then they don't have the taser. Well, why didn't you tase him? But at any rate, getting back to your point, tasers are not 100%. And in fact, gunfire is not 100%. And let me just backtrack. I mentioned that the guy that I shot, even though he was dead, he fought us for another 45 seconds or so. So even gunfire doesn't stop people. Now, when we talk about a taser, it's an electronic control weapon, electric control device, whatever term you want to use. And it shoots out two probes. And the effective range for a taser is about 12 to 15 feet. And what you're gambling if you are using a taser in a situation where you believe your life is in jeopardy is you're gambling that you'll get two probes that will hit in the appropriate place, that they will penetrate whatever clothing the individual is wearing, that will get onto the person's skin, and then the voltage that is put in will incapacitate the person. It's designed to get what we call neuromuscular incapacitation. The problem is that under all sorts of conditions, the officer's moving, the suspect's moving, the two probes don't always hit. If you don't have two good probe hits, it's not going to work. Other thing, even though if you get two hits, one probe or both might get hung up in the clothing, and therefore it's not going to work. And the third thing is some people can simply fight through a taser. And so what you're basically doing is you're gambling with your life that this device is going to work. And so police officers are trained that in a deadly force situation, you only use a taser if you have what we call lethal cover or lethal backup. And so consequently, one officer by himself to deploy a taser, if he believes that his life is in jeopardy, is probably not the wisest course of action.
Right. They also can be affected by the wind.
Oh,
if
absolutely.
If there's any kind of a breeze, those probes might miss their mark by a great margin. Chris?
I'd like to add one thing. While I point out that he did not have a taser, Officer Wilson did testify that he did have a baton with him, and he also did have mace. He said that he didn't want to use mace because during the struggle when they were in the car, he was concerned that it was going to blind him as well.
That is another factor, Dave Klinger, the use of mace for just that very reason.
Absolutely. And one of the problems when you are in a close quarter contact fight, we call it cross-contamination. And if you go on YouTube, I'm sure that our listeners could find video of two officers struggling with someone, and one officer maces the suspect and gets the other officer, and the other officer is now out of the fight. And so mace, oleoresin capsicum, or some other type of chemical agent has its place, but once again, it doesn't always work. And in fact, I'm thinking of two cases right now. When I was a young police officer, we're in foot pursuits of suspects. And one case, the guy gets hung up on a fence for a moment, and both my partner and I hit him with very good streams from about 12 feet away of the chemical agent that we carried. And the guy just laughed at us and took off running. We eventually caught him. The second time I hit a guy with the mace, he went right down. So I've got a 50-50 in terms of my effectiveness. And once again, if it's a deadly force situation, I don't want to gamble my life on that.
I've just been advised, by the way, that there is a demonstration going on downtown now, apparently at this moment. Our Camille Phillips has reported that the protesters just marched past the city garden on Market Street downtown. So we'll be watching that. Stay tuned to St. Louis Public Radio throughout the afternoon. Just a little time left. Very quickly, Dave Klinger, as you know, I did some work for law enforcement training for a number of years.
Yes.
And the one thing that kept popping up with all that we did in that particular life was the first thing that an officer thinks about when he walks out of the house every day is survival, is coming home. I've heard that 1,000 times.
Absolutely. And officers have to think that way. The problem is you can't let that cloud your judgment or color your judgment to the point where you perceive things that are not deadly jeopardy as deadly jeopardy. I mentioned that policing is dangerous. Obviously, I talked about my shooting. And most police officers are never confronted with a situation where someone's going to try to kill them. But what we know is that every day in the United States, some police officer is confronted with a situation where someone's going to try to kill them. And so consequently, are you willing to play the lottery and say, oh, I'm just going to be lazy. I'm not going to pay attention to my safety and risk the chance that you're that one officer of the several hundred thousand that are going to be on duty that day. And some officers, unfortunately, have that attitude, and they end up in the morgue.
Right. Chris, just a few seconds left to you with what you've been able to glean from what you've read so far from these transcripts. Did you see anything that changed any previous notions you might have had?
Well, we talked a little bit about the discrepancy in size and how it was actually much less than you would be led to believe. I think one other thing that stuck out to me that we did not discuss on the program is that according to his testimony, Officer Wilson did not think he needed to go to the hospital, but that was actually a decision that was made by his assistant chief after speaking with his lawyer.
All right. Well, I know you're going to get back to work and look at the other 4,400 pages that you haven't been able to do up to this point.
600 down, 4,400 more to go.
Well, good luck on that, Chris McDaniel. Thank you so much for being with us in studio. Dave Klinger, always nice to talk to you, and we appreciate your being with us
as well.
And to all our other guests, thank you. I can't name you all by name, but thank you all for being with us today. Tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, we'll continue our conversation about the aftermath of the grand jury decision and take a look at what's next. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.